It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're coming in with a little happiness from Pharrell Williams today to celebrate the International Day of Happiness. And you can tell us what makes you happy or post a picture of something that makes you happy on the Central Time Facebook page.
It's March 20th, which makes it the second annual International Day of Happiness. The United Nations General Assembly pegged today as a time for the world community to think about the relevance of happiness and well-being to people around the globe and to encourage nations to pursue happiness in their public policy objectives.
Joining us now to talk about the International Day of Happiness is Lisa Napoli. She's an arts reporter for KCRW in Los Angeles and the author of Radio Shangri-La, What I Discovered on My Accidental Journey to the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. Lisa, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Let's start with the International Day of Happiness. Why does the UN think we need it?
Well, it's so loaded, the word happiness. But basically, the United Nations is looking at rejiggering how we consider happiness. Happiness isn't about stuff. It's not necessarily about having lots and lots of money. They're encouraging people to look at the idea that the gross domestic product, this land grab for money and stuff, is not really what we need to be happy, what's best for our well-being. So it's about getting people to step back and pause and think differently about what happiness is.
Are there consistent measures of what makes people happy across cultures and nations, or is it different in every country?
Well, basically, the bottom line, if you look at happiness economics, which is a growing field over the last 15 years or so, basically, the bottom line is if you have a roof over your head, if you have enough food to eat, if you have family and love and access to things like education and health care and clean drinking water for the people in your family, that's what the benchmark is for happiness. All the studies show that you don't have to be rich to be happy. It does, of course, help to have the basics in life. But what is basic to you in one country might be different than what's basic to somebody in Bangladesh, of course. But the bottom line is that. And the reason you're talking to me is the book I wrote, Radio Shangri-La, is about a little country that for many years was considered to be the quote-unquote happiest kingdom on earth, because Bhutan, which is a tiny country in the Himalayas, is in fact, by typical metrics of finances, very poor, but was found to be a very happy place for quite a long time. Part of that has to do with the fact that Bhutan didn't have television until 1999, so there wasn't a big consumer influx telling people there what they didn't have, which of course doesn't make you very happy.
Part of the goal here, it sounds like, is to make this a public policy priority. But how can a nation, a government, change their laws to encourage happiness?
Well, that's the tricky part. You know, of course, when you say it like that, of course, that's impossible to legislate.
I mandate happiness.
Right. You must be happy. You will be happy. Otherwise, you can't live here.
Or you will be punished.
Or you will be punished. But I happen to be talking to you from Santa Monica, which is right now looking at different ways of encouraging well-being in the community, in the sense that, of course, we're famous here in Los Angeles area for terrible traffic and long commutes. All of us as a nation are not so great much of the time about health and fitness and eating well. So governments all around the world are following the Bhutan lead, the gross national happiness index that they've created, and looking at ways to tweak and make better, more available things that make life better. For instance, cutting down commutes, encouraging people to eat more healthfully, to exercise, to spend more time with each other. And of course, all of those things are super complicated, right? Because, you know, yes, we can all say, as we know well, everybody should have health care. It doesn't quite work that way. But the idea that the UN is leading this movement to get people to think differently about happiness, that it isn't just money, 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 work, 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 but spending time with your family, being able to enjoy the outdoors, preserving nature, those are issues that come up time and again in any community around the world. And not to simplify it, because it isn't simple, but it is also very important to, as every study shows, to our well-being, being with each other, spending time with each other, eating healthfully, eating slowly, deliberately, not rushing.
Is there any evidence that happier countries are also maybe more successful countries?
Well, you have, places like Denmark and the Netherlands. The Scandinavian countries are just high marks in every sense, in the way that the people are treated, the way the people, actually, I shouldn't say that, because there are all kinds of bad things going on right now in the Netherlands, racist movements and all of that. But the government policies there are to support education and to support healthcare. Of course, those places are wealthier places than places like the Kingdom of Bhutan in terms of sheer economics. But the problem with this whole dialogue, and it's a great thing that we're having it, is that it's really hard to just say wholesale that one place is better than another. Anybody in any of those other places in the Scandinavian countries, there are issues everywhere. But countries that do commit to gross national happiness ideals over gross domestic product do show that people are generally, and this is hugely generalizing, but generally better off, happier day to day. And again, happy is not skipping down the street smiling. It's wellness. It's the internal wellness that's what's most important.
Well, you mentioned the time you spent in Bhutan. Did it feel like a happy place? Did the people seem content or however observably happy?
Well, what's so interesting is that in many ways, people there did seem like they were happier. But part of it is that here in this country, we don't always take time to talk to each other about whether we're doing well or how we're feeling. That community, that sense of community that we all crave and that we sometimes overlook is still existent in a place like Bhutan, because it is a smaller place. It is a place that's more connected in terms of the old-fashioned connectivity. That, of course, is changing rapidly as technology comes in. People, all you need to do is go on my Facebook page, look me up, Lisa Napoli on Facebook, and you'll see a lot of young Bhutanese people there who are angsting over various issues. But it is a happier place in the sense that the government there is committed to the well-being of its people in the sense of the nature and in the sense of making life more comfortable. That said, there are issues in Bhutan, as there are around the world, where people are excluded, people of certain races and religions are excluded. So it is very, very complicated. But I did find myself personally while I was in Bhutan how much happier I felt being in a place where the speed was slowed down.
Bhutan is an example of a country that is moving slowly into the technological age. I imagine it has less material resources in general, including economics, money, than a place like Denmark. But do you think that the politics enters into this? Is happiness a political thing? You mentioned the Scandinavian countries, and they tend to usually, I think, score pretty high in terms of the happiness factor of their citizens. And they are also countries that have pretty significant social safety nets.
Right. And they are also places that don't necessarily have a huge governmentally kind of orchestrated commitment to religion, for lack of a better way of putting it, whereas Bhutan is a deeply religious, largely Buddhist country, where they've been trying to institute, or they have been instituting, meditation in the mornings at school as a way to get people to sort of reset and recalibrate. And even there, that was a complex and not always easy to to sell kind of thing. So it's a complicated thing. Yes, a richer country is going to have a different take on it than a poorer country. Bhutan's government is, their hallmark is this, pretty much by accident, because gross national happiness was just a phrase uttered by the fourth king years and years ago that has taken on a life of its own. It's a pithy, ironically, marketing slogan in many ways, or it's become that, when in fact the essence of gross national happiness is anti-marketing. Don't let consumeristic values govern your happiness, your well-being, how you live your life. Allow what's inward to guide you. And that's why, again, many of the happiness economics metrics and people who study this say the people who are of faith, whatever that faith is, are often happier than people who aren't, because they're not letting external forces govern what they do, how they behave.
Lisa, thank you so much for joining us, and happy International Day of Happiness.
Happy Happiness Day to you, too. Thank you so much for asking me to talk about it.
Yeah. Lisa Napoli.
And happy spring.
Yes, that, too, happens in Wisconsin. We're ready for that. Well, we've been talking to Lisa Napoli, an arts reporter for KCRW in Los Angeles, and the author of Radio Shangri-La.